This is Audible.
Tanter Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Heartberries, a memoir, by Therese Marie Myatt, narrated by Rainey Fields. I want you to know, if you ever read this, there was a time when I would rather have had you by my side than any one of these words. I would rather have had you by my side than all the blue in the world. Maggie Nelson. Introduction by Sherman Alexie. Therese Marie Myatt arrived in my life via vision. Well, she was due to give birth at any moment and couldn't attend the writing workshop in person, so she was beamed into the classroom via Skype or iChat or Facebook streaming on somebody's laptop. She became the cyborg writer in the room. It was hilarious at first. It never stopped being hilarious. But as the week went on, I realized that Therese's lack of physical presence gave her voice more power. When she spoke, we all had to lean toward the computer to better hear. And then we'd sometimes forget she was in the room. It's easy to forget about a computer. But then Therese would speak, would politely seek our attention, and we'd turn toward that laptop as if it were a shrine. Hilarious. It all seemed like a contradiction. But that 21st century technology turned Therese into an ancient. Well, it made her feel like she was powered by something ancient. So in reading Heartberries, I was not surprised to learn that Therese, as a child in search of answers, in search of protection, pretended to be ancient. I didn't say any of this at the time. I didn't want to single her out or praise her too much. I was a professor and I needed to be fair, objective, and critical. But what I really wanted to say was, Therese, when I sat down with your manuscript and began to read your words, I was aware within maybe three sentences that I was in the presence of a generational talent. I was in the presence of something new. To be glib, Therese is putting the original in aboriginal. So yeah, I didn't say it then, but I am saying it now. Therese Marie Myatt has arrived in all of our lives now, and she is ancient. She is pretending to be ancient. She is speaking from an ancient place. She is smart and a smart ass. She is wounded and seeking to wound. She is forgiving and vengeful. She is mentally ill and smarter than all of us. She is cynical and deeply, deeply romantic. She is a metaphorical love child of Emily Dickinson and Crazy Horse. She is the biological child of a broken healer and a lonely artist. Therese is a healer and an artist. She is broken and she is lonely. Just read a few of her out-of-context sentences. Observation isn't easy, and the right eyes can make me feel like a deer, while the wrong ones make me feel like a monster. The distinctness of my bed and its corners are fucked by my fucking you. I don't think I can forgive myself for my compassion. I am not too ugly for this world. I walk backward up the steps, knowing my feet like I never did. This book is not only a memoir, it is poetry. It is meditation. It is mystical, but not in the kind of old-time Indian way that Therese wants to avoid. It is a hard-earned mysticism, a blue-collar mysticism, the mysticism of calloused hands and blistered feet. It is the mysticism of resilience, or something larger than resilience. As you will discover in listening to this book, Therese is suspicious of the word resilience. She is suspicious of all words, because she is acutely aware of their ability to heal and harm, often at the same time. But as a writer, as a storyteller, Therese returns to the words, to the stories, because she must. She doesn't have a choice. She was given this extraordinary gift, and this gift of vision, of words, has sent her screaming into the night. It has left her weeping naked in the shower. It has pushed her into a mental hospital. It has fractured her family and her own soul. But here she is, still standing, and she is interrogating the world. She is the judge and jury. But she is a powerful indigenous woman who interrogates herself. Yes, I think in the end, this is perhaps why I believe Therese is a spectacular talent. She is willing to look deep into the mirror and tell us what she sees. And in doing so, Therese herself becomes a mirror, and we can see our reflections. Therese is unafraid now. Does that mean she is calling on us, her reflections, to be unafraid too? Or maybe Therese just accepts her fear. Does that mean we should accept our fear too? I don't know the answer to that question. Therese wants to be torn apart by everything. So does that mean I should want to be torn apart too? I don't know. But I am certainly aware that Heartberries has torn me apart, and I fully expect, as I read it again, as I keep rereading it over the years, that Therese and her stories will put me back together. Sherman Alexie, July 27th, 2017. 1. Indian Condition. My story was maltreated. The words were too wrong and ugly to speak. I tried to tell someone my story, but he thought it was a hustle. He marked it as solicitation. The man took me shopping with his pity. I was silenced by charity, like so many Indians. I kept my hand out. My story became the hustle. Women asked me what my end game was. I hadn't thought about it. I considered marrying one of the men and sitting with my winnings, but I was too smart to sit. I took their money and went to school. I was hungry and took more. When I gained the faculty to speak my story, I realized I had given men too much. The thing about women from the river is that our currents are endless. We sometimes outrun ourselves. I stopped answering men's questions or their calls. Women asked me for my story. My grandmother told me about Jesus. We knelt to pray. She told me to close my eyes. It was the only thing she asked me to do properly. She had conviction, but she also taught me to be mindless. We started recipes and lost track. We forgot ingredients. Our cakes never rose. We started an applehead doll. The shrunken, carved head sat on a bookshelf years after she left. When she died, nobody noticed me. Indian girls can be forgotten so well they forget themselves. My mother brought healers to our home, and I thought she was trying to exorcise me. A little ghost. Psychics came. Our house was still ruptured. I started to craft ideas. I wrapped myself in a Pendleton blanket and picked blueberries. I pretended I was ancient. A healer looked at me. He was tall and his jeans were dirty. He knelt down. I thought I was in trouble, so I told him that I had been good. He said, "You don't need to be nice." My mother said that was when I became trouble. That's when my nightmares came. A spinning wheel, a white porcelain tooth, a snarling mouth, and lightning haunted me. My mother told me they were visions. "Turn your shirt backward to confuse the ghost," she said, and sent me to bed. My mother insisted that I embrace my power. On my first day of school, I bound myself a small book. The teacher complimented my vocabulary, and my mother told me school was a choice. She fed me traditional food. I went to bed early every night, but I never slept well. I fell ill with tuberculosis. Mother brought back the healers. I told them my grandmother was speaking to me. Zohar, a white mystic, a tarot reader, told me she spoke to spirits too. "Your grandmother says she misses you," she said. "We could never make a cake," I said. "She was just telling me that." "What ingredient did you usually forget?" Zohar asked. I knew this was a test, but a strange one, because she didn't speak to my grandmother either. I remember my mother was watching us, holding her breath. "Eggs," I said. My spiritual fraud distanced my grandmother's spirit from me. It became harder to stomach myself and harder to eat. "Does that happen to you?" I said. "What?" Zohar asked. "Did you ever want to stop eating?" "No," she said. Zohar asked my mother if she could sleep next to my bed on the floor. She listened to me all night, storytelling. What potential there was in being awful. My mindlessness became a gift. I didn't feel compelled to tell any moral tales or ancient ones. I learned how story was always meant to be for Indian women, immediate and necessary and fearless, like all good lies. My story was maltreated. I was a teenager when I got married. I wanted a safe home. Despair isn't a conduit for love. We ruined each other, and then my mother died. I had to leave the reservation. I had to get my GED. I left my home because welfare made me choose between necessities. I used a check and some cash I saved for a ticket away, and knew I would arrive with a deficit. That's when I started to illustrate my story, and exactly when it became a means of survival. The ugly truth is that I lost my son Isidore in court. The Hague Convention. The ugly of that truth is that I gave birth to my second son as I was losing my first. My court date and my delivery aligned. In the hospital, they told me that my first son would go with his father. "What about this boy?" I said, with Isaiah in my arms. "They don't seem interested yet," my lawyer said. I brought Isaiah home from the hospital and then packed Isidore's bag. My ex-husband, Vito, took him along with police escorts. Before they left, I asked Vito if he wanted to hold his new baby. I don't know why I offered, but he didn't kiss our baby or tell him goodbye. He didn't say he was sorry, or that it was unfortunate. Who wants one boy and not another? It's too ugly to speak this story. It sounds like a beggar. How could misfortune follow me so well, and why did I choose it every time? I learned how to make a honey reduction of the ugly sentences. Still, my voice cracks. I packed my baby and left my reservation. I came from the mountains to an infinite and flat brown to bury my grief. I left because I was hungry. In my first writing classes, my professor told me that the human condition was misery. I'm a river widened by misery, and the potency of my language is more than human. It's an Indian condition to be proud of survival, but reluctant to call it resilience. Resilience seems ascribed to a human conditioning in white people. The Indian condition is my grandmother. She was a nursery teacher. There are stories that she brought children to our kitchen, gave them laxatives, and then put newspaper on the ground. She squatted before them and made faces to illustrate how hard they should push. She dewormed children this way, and she learned that in residential school, where parasites and nuns and priests contaminated generations of our people, Indians froze trying to run away, and many starved. Nuns and priests ran out of places to put bones, so they built us into the walls of new boarding schools. I can see grandmother's face in front of those children. Her hands felt like rose petals, and her eyes were soft and round like buttons. She liked carnations and canned milk. She had a big heart for us kids. She transcended resilience and actualized what Indians weren't taught to know. We are unmovable. Time seems measured by grief and anticipatory grief, but I don't think she even measured time. 2. Heartberries. You had a hard-on for my oratory. Some of my stories were fabricated. I had authority, a thing that people like you haven't witnessed. It comes from a traditional upbringing and regarding my work as something more sacred than generations of effort or study. It's something on a continuum, so far-reaching you know it came from an inhuman place. Story is inhuman and beyond me, and I'm not sure you ever recognized that. You knew to be excited in proximity to my power. We started the affair in a small booth at Village Inn. I didn't sleep the night before. You were my teacher, and we discussed my fiction. My work was skeletal before you. I waited for the right silence and then said flatly that I liked you. "Do we get a hotel?" you said. Your hands were shaking. I reached out and touched them. They were double mine and whiter. I knew before I was close to you that your cotton blue hoodie smelled like smoke, and I could put my entire body beneath it. I knew that your skin wasn't rough. I knew that I was not going to be the same person for loving you. We went back to our respective lives. We agreed to talk about it sometime soon. It was winter. I wore a brown corduroy jacket most days, and I remember waiting to be with you, putting my fingers in the jacket pockets until the pockets couldn't contain my incessant want. My fingers felt swollen with focus and desire. I remember pulling threads, looking in the mirror, and seeing myself how you might see me. New. While I waited, I went on a trip with a man I barely liked. You didn't call for 2 days. He insisted on sleeping in the same bed in our cabin. Our room had a skylight. I couldn't enjoy anything without acknowledging he was in the room. I tried to bathe alone, and he played a guitar on the other side of the door. I was bored and asked for horses. "What?" he said. "I want to be on a horse," I said. We were somewhere mountainous, and it was snowing. He spent the morning calling stalls and asking for rates. He seemed offended when I told him I needed a warmer sweater, matching gloves, and that the breakfast we had wasn't right, and that I might need wool socks as well. He seemed surprised that I was not fun-loving. I was rude and gratuitous. I went horseback riding with the man. He was almost jaundiced. He was so sick in love with me. I wanted as much of the world as I could take, and I didn't have the conscience to be ashamed. You messaged me when I was playing slots with the man. You messaged that you had left your girlfriend for me. You asked me how soon we could meet. I told the man I was ready to go home. It was urgent. He planned to go ice skating, but I said no. He planned a tour of a haunted house, but I said no. The man I had been conditioning was not happy with me. He knew something was wrong, and that's when I wondered if maybe falling in love looked like a crisis to an observer. You had a jawline, and I wanted to crawl under your gaze, under your chin. I was desirous to be beneath you. The first few nights, you tell me things. "I'd burn my life down for you," you said. There was still so much to tell you, things too ugly to know or say. I wanted to know what I looked like to you. "A sin committed and a prayer answered," you said. You looked like a hamburger fried in a donut. You were hairy and large. Falling in love felt fluid. It snowed when we fell in love. Everything reminded me of warm milk. Everything seemed less real. I thought my cup was overflowing. I found myself caressing my own face. My son and I let you visit. I told him my friend was coming. He put on a Batman costume and hid behind the couch until you came. "When is he coming?" Isaiah said. "Any minute." When you arrived, Isaiah sprung out and stood quietly. You received him so well. You let him be weird. He was 7, and his fingers were perpetually sticky. My son was a smaller bolt of lightning, uncontained and sweeter than me. You were patient with him, and I watched you both put together a Lego set. Safety wasn't familiar, not with men. Our life felt brighter together. We started to argue about autonomy and the agency I lacked with you. Neither one of us could pull away, so things erupted. Both of us had jobs and commitments. Our lives became less productive when productivity was pivotal. Your agent called. I was underneath your chin, burying my nose into your chest and searching with my hands. You finally sold your book. Your neighbors had horses and chickens, but the land was insufficiently small. The place always smelled like manure, but not in the worst of winter. Scents can freeze. So many things were signs. The Spanish radio station you put on during our drives. You said you were trying to immerse yourself in the language. I sunk into myself. I knew better. White people are brutally awkward, even you. You didn't pamper me like the men I had conditioned. You didn't jump to buy things. You thought of us as equals. You expected me to do things and wondered why I wanted everything on the menu. You didn't take out your wallet and tell me who I was. Those moments never came. You ruined me with touch. It was a different exploitation. You asked me for my secret. I told you about the son who didn't live with me. I told you that I lock myself in the bathroom to cry when I remember his milk breath. I knew what it felt like to sleep next to him in bed, and he was just gone. I told you I'd go away. You said you'd be on the other side of the door. That's how perfect love is at first. Solutions are simple, and problems are laid out simply. I knew that the way I had been living was too complicated for you to see up close. I should have consulted a healer before I went further with you. Our culture is based in the profundity things carry. We're always trying to see the world the way our ancestors did. We feel less of a relationship to the natural world. There was a time when we dictated our beliefs and told ourselves what was real, or what was wrong or right. There weren't any abstractions. We knew that our language came before the world. I knew I was not well. I thought of the first healer who was just a boy. My friend Denise told me the story. She called him Heartberry Boy, or Odemin. His name means strawberry in the language. Denise and I struggled and came up together. She named her son after the boy. The people in his village were sick and dying because the Indian world was shifting. The boy lost his mother. Odemin became a sorrowful kid who found solace in the dream world. He fell asleep and spun a restlessness that comes when people are waiting to die. Sometimes grief is a nothing feeling. The spirits finally came to him in a dream and told him to leave the village. He asked the elders what he should do, and they told him their own dreams, and that he should introduce himself by name and lineage to a bear and follow her until she gave him a gift. He walked alone in the valley, and when Bear presented herself, she stood tall. They looked at each other. He followed her. She sunk her paws into wet dirt, and then he told her his name. She started to feel sick. Her heaving seemed bloody and reminded him of his mother. Bear told him she was not his mother. She told him to let her rest, but he didn't. She said, "You can't expect me to unearth medicine and give you power unless you give your life to this." She was willing to die to keep her secrets from weak people. He sat with her. She put her claws into a strawberry patch and produced ripe berries. She ate and slept. He collected some berries and brought them to the people. Eventually, he started to plant and show others what he learned. This was how the first medicine man came to be. I learned that any power asks you to dedicate your life to its expansion. Things feel continuous when I think of my gifts and heritage. With you, things don't feel right sometimes. I believe you obstruct my healing. What I notice with you is that I look outside whenever I'm close to a window, and I wonder how many women feel that way. I feel things I would rather feel alone. Things have become more real with you. Every time I start to cry, you tell me that you can't keep me from leaving. I feel abject without your passion. I feel uncontrollable with you. In bed, daylight breaks through our tented sheets. I see you, Casey. You will always love me in a shadow. It's not torturous to be with you when I consider being without. Instead of feeling the gasping pain of my powerlessness, I straddle it and put your hands on my breasts. I tell you that I'd burn my life down for you. We try to remember each other this way, and I'm not sure how many times I can do this to you before I forget myself. I want you to will my pain away. I try to think that the things I do to you, I won't ever do harder to someone else. I guess heartbreak is simple. Problems seem to unfurl themselves like crumpled bills on a nightstand. The first night that I locked myself away, you didn't even notice I was gone. Every door is the same when I kneel in a corner, with a hand over my mouth. Every bathroom floor is different, but no morning I do feels familiar. It feels brand new. 3. Indian sick. Casey, I want to be polite and present myself as decent. I know the math of regret and nostalgia. The potency of your touch times the distance between that touch and today determines the intensity of my desperation. I regret leaving you, and I'm disappointed you let me go. I don't remember what I did. I know that I cried next to you, and I was wearing lingerie. You were angry with me for wanting to die. More than that, you were upset that I was weak-minded. I was dramatic and unhinged. I couldn't placate. I know that's what I should have done. I remember that I was wearing black lace and new stockings. I wasn't stable, but men don't usually care about that. I didn't perform. I found myself uncovered and vulnerable, in fabric so thin. I thought of everything I've belted against my flesh and unclasped again and again. You used me. I know you think animals are sentient. You treat your dog well. I needed to talk to you. The way we operate asks a lot from me before I can ask something of you. This letter can spiral out of control like me, and maybe you won't read it, because I might fail to send it, or you might decide your life without me is worth maintaining. You have white sensibilities, and who can fault you for being practical? I'd like this letter to be ashamed and wild like me, and I'd like to know you read it and wanted me more. I told the staff this is my journal. I'm going to die an Indian death. I want to lay my neck on the cool steel alloy of the train tracks back home. I want the death of a res dog. Mutts can't keep away from the tracks. I'm writing you from a behavioral health service building. I agreed to commit myself under the condition they would let me write. You should have thought before you made a crazy Indian woman your lover. Feel culpable in my insanity because you are partly to blame. I am not good, but you knew that. Why think less of me in here? You're so economic with your language and your time. I understand your frustration with me. You want to spare yourself any tax or energy, and I am acutely aware of my impulsivity. It might be all the same to you. Do you still love me? I still want you. Don't think less of me for being crazy. Don't think that I am the only one culpable in my craziness. I was walking through the house in the dark. I had covered the windows and mirrors. I was just unseeing things, dragging my feet along the wood panels until I found myself in the kitchen. I could not forget the familiarity of the kitchen or its drawers and instruments. Keep in mind, you were once desperate for me. I need help, and I cannot stop thinking that every transgression has brought me closer to a light, a striking beacon that tells me death is absolution. I have never chosen light. If transgressions were all bad, people wouldn't do them. Do you consider me a transgression? I'm tired of the constant stories and the truth I don't acknowledge. They're not medicine anymore. I'm not medicine anymore. The words are flaccid, and the things I used to find sacred are torment. I'm stepping into my own undertow. My own valley is closing in on me. I curl into walls, ashamed at my cowardice. I am sick or possessed. The spirits used to possess the people. We called it Indian sick, and it was the first illness to be accounted for. It begins with want, with taking, and ends with a silence that hurts and makes us beg. There were stories about the cures and causes. Women tried to eat soap berries or nothing, and talked about how we all had it coming. When the first children died, it was too late to stop talking. When the beings took the women, they bound them in blood. They were buried in wombs of sad memory. The only thing, the right thing, the thing that brought about our immunity, was the knowledge that something instinctual would carry us back. The awareness that our ancestors were watching was vital. I don't feel the eyes of my grandmother anymore. What I feel struck with is something smaller, in a less impressive world. I woke up today, confused, inside of something feminine and ancestral in its misery. I woke up as the bones of my ancestors locked in government storage. My illness has carried me into white buildings, into the doctor's office and the therapist, with nothing to say, other than I need my grandmother's eyes on me, smiling at my misguided heart. Imagine their faces when I say that. At the behavioral health service building, I felt something. A young woman staring at me. She was soft-looking and crazy-eyed, sitting with an old gray wool blanket in her lap. Avoiding her stare was the first task I failed at in the institution. "You're pretty," she said. "Thank you," I said. "No," she said. "Thank you." Scared, I smiled and nodded. We both looked out of place. And when I considered what kind of woman would look like she belonged here, I drew a blank. I got these moles, she said, and pointed to the five surrounding her mouth. They're spitballs from Jesus. It was a mistake to check myself in. So many people said something wasn't right. I told them you were my savior, and this is what neglect can do. They didn't believe me. It's important to be loved back. No matter. I'm a mother. My son will stay with a friend. Do this, they said. Something is wrong. I know. We passed the hours in the waiting room, watching the weather channel. We watched tornadoes and the fury of water wash around. Slowly, women were called in for assessment with psychiatrists, and then more women came in to wait. I was eventually alone on the couch. Regular to crazy-looking, I was somewhere in the middle, wearing an oversized black petticoat and a too red lipstick. There was a glass where workers observed us, and I recognized the man on the other side, Josue. Years before, we worked at a call center together. We had lunch a few times, and he told me about his night shifts at the hospital. He came outside and observed me in a quiet and careful way. Observation is a skill. Observation isn't easy, and the right eyes can make me feel like a deer, while the wrong ones make me feel like a monster. He stood in front of me with a binder in his hands. Therese, he said. No, don't do this, I said. He smiled. It's good you're here. I said a lot of things to fill a silence. He didn't want to know why I was there. I told him every reason except the truth. He was kind of a dick, in that it didn't matter what I said. He just smiled and sat with me for a moment and then went back to work. A nurse came in with a girl who couldn't have been older than 18. Sit, the nurse said. Calm your tits, the young girl said, turning to me. Wild night? The fuzz of the couch came off in my hand. The orange fur of it was familiar. A nurse came out of a gray door and motioned for me. I followed her into a room. She left me there with the door cracked. There was an urge to leap and run. The doctor walked in. She was petite and wore a blush hijab with wine-colored lipstick. On a scale of 1 to 10, how bad is your depression? 7, I said. 7's not a 10. She smiled. Why are you here? This is the last thing I can do. Do you have a plan to hurt yourself? It's dramatic. I don't think it's a real plan, I said. She sat up straighter. I think things would be better if I was dead. She told me there was a better solution to pain, and that she's seen it herself. She asked me to stay for 5 days. I'd be out 2 days before Christmas. I had already bought my son's gifts. I asked her if I could write. She said yes. I asked her if I would be out before Christmas for sure. She said yes. Do this program for you, she said. The forms made me feel big. My signature mattered. I was signing a new treaty. The gamut of questions and searches through my bag lasted for hours, and during that time, several nurses pointed out that things do, in fact, get better. Before I left intake, Josue approached me with a digital camera. We need this for headcounts, he said. I had cut my hair before I committed myself. I had thin eyebrows, which I overplucked, and I wanted bangs to cover them as they grew out. I was meticulous in my preparation. I packed books and lotion and shower gel and every outfit I felt I could wallow in. Dark clothes and cotton t-shirts. He took my picture, and I asked to see it. Another, I said. He had forgotten how sure of myself I could sound. He took another, and told me I could have smiled. He escorted me up 2 flights to the women's ward. It was late, so the workers showed me to my room and gave me a paper cone of water and 2 pills. I don't know what. I had to change into a hospital gown so they could examine what I wore. They said they would give it back to me soon. I am familiar with death, and I remembered it was heavy to hold. My mother's death was violent, internally. I remember once an elder skinned a rabbit in our yard. He wanted to teach me how to do it. He said so many times that a body is a universe. He slit the rabbit open and pointed with his knife to the thick parts of it. He said the word entropy. I remembered that when my mother died, a tube had stretched open the dry corners of her mouth. She was not given grace into the next world. When they pulled the tube from her throat, her lips were dry and her mouth fell open. Nothing is too ugly for this world, I think. It's just that people pretend not to see. I fell asleep trying to remember the composition of a tooth. Gum and bone support the softer things. The raw nerve in my tooth tingled under the weight of my tongue. I don't want my mouth to be obscene when I die. I was finally beneath myself at a new low. In the morning, I was the only one dressed in my hospital gown for breakfast. The nurses walked me back to my room and explained I should wear my clothes, which were put away in my dresser. I asked the women if there was a scale to weigh myself. I weighed 122 pounds the day before. They pointed to my dresser and left the room. There's no right way to dress in the hospital. Some women were dressed provocatively. I put on my cotton shirt and leggings, thinking of what threads weighed the least. In line, a stringy blonde woman who looked ill talked about meth, and everything she said seemed like a small lie. I stood behind her and just let her lead the way. Her feet and mouth seemed so urgent and dangerous. The cafeteria was co-ed, and the men looked violent. I didn't eat because I considered the pills I had taken might have been the type that made me hungry, the type that allowed me to eat until I'd realize I was full. It feels like a skill to refrain. The benefit in this place is that I must refrain from you. I can't physically see you or know what you're doing. The nurses escorted us back to the ward, and then they pulled me aside for a full tour. The brunette nurse asked me if I believed in God, and the smart one said I looked heartbroken. "Is this about a man?" she said. I felt breathless, like every question was a step up a stairway. "Casey, it was more than surreal. I needed a drink, but I reminded myself not to say that out loud, even in jest. The women walked me to the reading room. "Nobody reads in here," the smart one said. "It's quiet." The nurses smelled good because everything in there, including us, was sterilized and without distinction. They smelled like their homes and lunches and living. "You're welcome to read so long as it doesn't take away from your healing," the brunette said. "We have romance novels in stock and some books from the Oprah Book Club." I did enjoy Oprah. The art room was all colored paper, glue, and glitter. The pool was stagnant. The birds outside offended me. Domestic, but free. All of the rooms were stark white, but the lighting was dim, so everyone looked bleaker. A dull blue stripe ran along every room for the invalids to follow. They gave me an Ambien, and I walked the line, stopping at every barred window. I wanted to hear the world, but the glass was too thick. It was funny and hurtful to see the women walking past my room to glimpse at me and assess what type of crazy I was. Every few minutes, I saw a new girl who looked sad or angry. We mirrored each other's blank stares. It was nice to feel at home in that odd place. I tidied my room like I never do at home. "You said you loved to failure. I made you full and flushed. You loved me until your body failed your will. You said making love was kissing my eyelids. I kept them open once and saw you differently. You rooted against me and forced my eyes closed like little coffins. I wondered how many bitter ghosts it took to create a cold feeling in a room. My face was covered in your sweat. I was all points and sharp corners before I loved you. You don't appreciate that you've broken me. Lovers want to undo their partners. I feel unveiled and more work than you had bargained for. I was unsure of the currency of men and unaware that losing myself would feel so physical. I remember when I spent the night with you once. In the morning, I wanted to order a proper breakfast with potatoes and an egg with toast and another breakfast of French toast and maple syrup and butter. You tell me it's too much. You don't think I'm gracious. I ordered the proper breakfast, and the server didn't bring me toast. I complained, and then she brought cold toast. And then I complained again, and then my food went cold. My eyes welled, and you looked disgusted. I usually don't care about that look. What right does a man have to look at me like that? I think it's justifiable to hurt someone when they look at me like that. We fought for hours, and I didn't say that my mother had spent her life waiting for service. I waited with her in cafes for an order of French fries or something small we could afford. White women didn't greet her or consider our time. We walked into places, and sometimes men heckled me. I said I was 12, and they often didn't believe me. My mother and I found solace, driving hours out of our neighborhood, where being Indian was not much of a crime. If I told you that, I would also need to stop and note the significance of so many other things. My mind is overwhelmed with breakfast alone. I don't eat for days, so you can run your hands over my rib cage. You told me that you always want to eat ribs afterward. I don't eat for days because I can't afford it. The meal I order after being fucked by you or anyone is something earned. Men objectify me to such a degree that they forget I eat. You feed your dog more kindly than you feed me. That's men. That was also my problem, an inability to distinguish you from other men when I am angry. I'm sorry. If only you could see how little I need in this hospital. I have been vulnerable, but I have never felt this threatened before. I thought I knew what the worst outcomes could be until I ended up here. I didn't know not being enough or being so wrong about someone would feel this way. You got the message, I asked my friend to relay. You left me a message, and the nurses said you sounded concerned. I called you from the community phone, but you were not available. I don't even know what to say, so I ask you to visit me. I hope that when you get my message, you are alone. Nobody would advise you seeing me. You are capable of a finality I can't exact. I sat in the reading room for 5 hours watching women color. The women in here take coloring seriously. They're territorial over the colors. That's an earthy green, Patricia said to me. You should use something brighter. Patricia looked bothered by my work. She was an apple-faced older woman with white hair and a soft voice. She was taken here against her will, so she had no clothes of her own. Her breasts hung low in her gown. I don't know, Patricia, Lori said. It's kind of like a rich, lustery green. That's how green stems are. Patricia smiled and passed me the right color. Lori told me that I should color and speak to other women and never watch the TV because they write that stuff down. She doesn't want to be released because she is homeless. She tried to kill herself with pills, and by some magic, she was discovered on the floor in her own vomit. She was living in transitional housing, and the suicide attempt wasn't an issue, but when the emergency responders searched her room, they found pills, which had been prescribed, along with 2 beer cans. They had a strict rule about alcohol. She was notified with a little sticky note from the nurses that she could no longer live in her home, and that someone else would inhabit her studio by the time she got out. Tall boys? I asked. No, she said. It was 2 small cans. Patricia hovered over her own flower to disengage from our talk. I didn't try anything, I said. I usually do try something when I get this bad. I usually take pills and vomit or something. Lori's hair made me nostalgic for my childhood. It was auburn and permed and gelled into a crunchy lion's mane. What I color is inside the lines and cute. A teacher's assistant in grade 1 asked me to draw a spoon. I took my time and drew an elaborate rainbow in its silhouette. I gave it a mouth and legs. She told me that passing relied on my ability to just draw a spoon. Then she handed me another paper. I used to forgetfully bring things home from school to show my father, years after he left. I have some memories of him painting. He held me tight in the cold of the basement. I used to sit on his lap for hours while he worked. "Look," he said, pointing to one of his birds. "What do you see?" "Eagle," I said. "Mother," he said. He looked a lot like Jim from Taxi. He had long, coarse hair, and he always wore light blue denim with an old baseball tee. He was lean, and my mother had a thing for tall, lean men. "I feel like I don't belong here, Casey. I feel like nothing here has helped. The psychiatrist advised against me leaving and threatened to get the courts involved. So I tried to engage myself with every material and exercise. They give each woman a large pink book that asks numerous questions to help parse out all the things that led up to their unraveling. The latter half of the book tries to wind the reader back together, asking them to find better ways to cope. Stop and think before you do something you regret. I don't like neat narratives or formulas. I go to group therapy. It is quite intense because, holy shit, there are a lot of women in the group who can articulate why they are here. It's been 40 years of silence for me, said Lori. My father raped me from age 6 to 10. The group counselor said that one must forgive for oneself and not for the perpetrator. This made little to no sense in my mind. We're all on meds here. Most of us are half zombie and half antsy, a weird mix. In white culture, forgiveness is synonymous with letting go. In my culture, I believe we carry pain until we can reconcile with it through ceremony. Pain is not framed like a problem with a solution. I don't even know that white people see transcendence the way we do. I'm not sure that their dichotomies apply to me. I found myself staring off during group, which made the counselor, Terry, prompt me for my story. I look for external validations of worth, and I always end up crazy over it, I said. It's good you can acknowledge that, Terry said. How long have you been doing that? My whole life. Isn't that what we learn as children? To look for affirmation in the external? Our fathers and mothers, I said. Some children are taught self-esteem from a young age, she said. Oh, I said. There's a girl with tight braids who posts up against the wall at group therapy. When Terry asks her to sit down, she says she doesn't want to. She says that she has to be here for 7 full days, no matter if she behaves or not. Terry explains self-esteem and its function, and I blame my mother for not saying these things. My mother wasn't big on esteem for herself, let alone trying to foster that in me. I think self-esteem is a white invention to further separate one person from another. It asks people to assess their values and implies people have worth. It seems like identity capitalism. Mom did teach me a story, though, along with Grandpa Crow. She knew that was my power, and she knew women need their power honed early, before it's beaten out of them by the world. I know what you're thinking. Casey, again with my mother? Yes. Unfortunately, that's the biggest part of my work in this place. The therapist seemed to think she's a link to my betterment. I think she did the best she could with the tools she had. The therapist said that's making excuses. Sometimes she had to lock herself away from the world. That's all. I have fond and bitter memories of her. I can't imagine what she'd think of me being here. My mother would have laughed at me. She'd have rolled in laughter and thrown her head back at my misery. She believed in subversion and turning things upside down. She mocked everything. My desire to be normal or sincere made her laugh. Men will never love you, she said once. They'll use you up, and when you're bone dry and it's your time to write, you'll be alone without a goddamn typewriter to your name. She had a lot taken from her. False starts took something out of her. And then having children and getting married and then divorced. All the jobs she had. And then there was the work at her desk and the several books she wrote. I feel like my body is being drawn through a syringe. Sometimes walking is hard. The gravity of Indian women's situations and the weight of our bodies are too much. Even Mom's cynicism was subversive. She often said nothing would work out. She often said that trying was futile and still dedicated her life to other people through social work. When she was unemployed, she rallied for social justice. She did things that required hopefulness. She made a name as an angry Indian woman who could consent and disallow things. Indian women are usually discouraged from that basic agency. Not to say that she wasn't betrayed and hurt. I remember well that I had to take care of myself. When I was a child, and I was as restless as I am now, I walked along the walls of our home, waiting for someone to come home and feed me, or bathe me, or take me outside. The phone rang once, and it was the unemployment office. I told the woman that my mother was at work. I thought lies were good when they made someone seem good. The strange thing about poverty is that maintaining a level of desperation and lack of integrity keeps the checks rolling in. Days after I picked up the phone, my mother lost her unemployment. She screamed until she cried and then said that if we didn't eat, it was my fault. I know, just like I know with my own child, she was sorry the moment the words escaped her mouth. The difference between her and I, as mothers, is that I don't have a sense of pride with my son. He is a small king. Still, he is as unfortunate as me, but at least he hasn't had to be home alone or starve. I have fostered love with compliments and carrying him even when he grew to be half my size. I prepared meals and spoon-fed him. Children are teachers in a way. My mother's burning ceremony was irreverent like her. We had plates of smoked salmon and the things our grandparents liked to eat, ready for the fire to take, and I heard someone joke they would put some wine in for Karen. The fire exploded across the lawn, and people said that it was Mom. It was that night I felt compelled to resist all the traditionalism of my mother, because I'm not sure how it served her children. She hated alcohol and stopped drinking before I was born. She was a pipe carrier and fasted alone in the mountains any time she had to. She built a sweat lodge by herself. She taught my brothers how to keep a fire and taught me how to prepare a feast. She spent years of my life waking up with the day to give thanks to the river. I never understood her commitment to living well. It seems innate that I am fucked up. I think I have the blood memory of my neurotic ancestors and their vices. Her work seems as important as my work. To acknowledge that some of my people slept in and wasted their lives and were gluttonous. For her burial, my brothers and I walked her ashes in a cedar box from the church to the grave. Dogs lingered behind the party. My aunt says at every funeral, there are some cultures where women are paid to wail, are revered for wailing better than others. There's a culture that makes crying a virtue and a gift. It felt like Mom's funeral lasted a year. It felt like one long winter, where my family told every story of hers by memory, as if we were being interrogated. My mother's spirit loomed over us, imploring us to avenge her death. But there were too many culprits, from the government to the reservation to her own family to whoever hurt her the very first time. I saw in pictures that between 13 and 14, my mother changed. That culprit, and then all our fathers, and the men who said they were down for the cause and then abandoned it, like they did their children. Those men killed my mother. Even the sweet lovers who gave her hope are the culprits of her pain. It's strange that my grandmother and my mother and my aunts died from blood clots or cancer. I think again of entropy and of the body. When my mother had her first aneurysm, I received a call from my siblings. I swear two of them held the receiver. They said, maybe in unison, Mom misses you. She isn't speaking. I don't like to say I am the sensible one in my family because we all are dependent on each other. Maybe I am the logical mechanism in the family, and I shudder to think that, with me here in a crazy house. They told me she was walking into walls. I called emergency and booked a flight home. I ran away from her as a girl, and a blood clot called me back. The first thing she did when she saw me was laugh. She didn't have the capacity to speak. They said she hadn't made any noises until I arrived. I touched her foot first and started a routine of questions to make her happy. Is there cable here? My show is on. I don't trust the white women with the IV. They'll do you like they do in the soaps. We're going to need a sign language for all the insults you can't call us. How will we know when you want to hit us? She was so small that her snarling was endearing. I always made her laugh. What little I have told you in the past seemed problematic. You seemed engaged by my dysfunction because you are a writer and not because I had experienced it. It is odd that I went to foster care while my mother worked in a group home, but it was not odd to me. I can only elaborate on the small things, like her smallness and how light her fists were, how she pinched the fat of my fingers to tell me she loved me. She was always aware of her struggle. A single mother with four children is destined to die from exhaustion, unless there is a miracle of fortune or justice. We came close to fortune and justice when I was a kid. Paul Simon needed correspondence, and my mother had written long before to an inmate named Salvador Agron for a Broadway play about Sal's life. He was convicted young and earned a degree on the inside. He became an activist, and that's how he met Mom. She spoke about Sal, like I speak about you. We should have waited for simpler things, but in many ways, my mother taught me love was divine, like a hermitage or vision or picking from the tree of knowledge. Mother didn't like the Bible, but I appreciate it for how suffering is related to profundity. Paul Simon called while I was watching TV. Our landline was screwed into the old 70s wood panel of our kitchen wall. I was ashamed of the house. The room was barren. There was an orange thrift shop dinette set and a shrine on our counter for Stevie Ray Vaughan. It was a picture of him surrounded by barks and sage my mother picked, with red ties and turquoise jewelry. The bracelets and rings were gifts from my Uncle Lyle, a jeweler who idolizes Elvis and wore a bouffant until old age turned it into a less voluminous side part. Mom was in the bath. Paul's voice was timid. He asked for Mom. I yelled to her that Paul was on the line. Mom told me to keep him on the phone while I heard her body emerge, splashes and her small wet feet running. How old are you? Simon asked.
I'm 10.
What do you do? I asked.
I'm an artist, he said.
I told him that was nice and asked him what kind of art. He laughed at me. My mother, wrapped in a towel, ripped the phone from my hand. She carried on several conversations like this. I began to suspect they were flirting when I went with Mom to the library to look up if Simon had a wife. I didn't want Paul Simon to be my new father. I saw an album cover once. He wore turtlenecks. He was pasty. He had beady eyes. He's married to some redhead, I think. White woman, Mom said. We had seen some news clippings and rented a biography. He was a god, and not the personalized one of benevolence, but the type who could take things away. She sent him every letter between herself and Salvador Agron. I had read the letters in our basement. There were images of horses and dirt and bodies and nothing of love until it became all about love. Simon was inspired by Salvador's plight. Mother's narrative was eventually drowned in Simon's version of it all, and nowhere was Sal's story. He was dead. We became self-important Indians with every call. Mom floated around the house after 3 day shifts at a group home and became happy. After years of writing manically in her room, someone was finally using her words. A camera crew came to interview Mom.